Good morning, everyone, and thank you for having the Nevada Supreme Court here for oral argument session with all of you. It's especially poignant for me because I went to Reno High School, and so it's a trip down memory lane to be here. I'd like to introduce the fellow members of justices on the court. To my immediate right is the Associate Chief Justice, Mark Gibbons. To his right is Justice Ron Perigary. And to his right is Justice Michael Cherry. To my immediate left is Justice Jim Hardesty, another former Husky. And to his left is Justice Michael Douglas. And to Justice Douglas's left is Justice Nancy Seda. What we do here is try to bring our oral arguments to you so that you can get an idea of what the court does in deciding cases. This is a bit different from TV shows, and I know you all know this, but we don't examine witnesses here. We don't re-decide questions of fact that may have been decided by a jury or by the trial court. We are an appellate court, and what that means is that we review the record and we review the briefs and the oral arguments for errors of law or errors in procedure that prevented somebody from getting a fair trial. We also look at constitutional issues, statutory issues, and just pure questions of evidence and so forth. It seems sort of dry. It's more of a debate than it is a courtroom challenge. And the lawyers here today will be acting a little bit out of their roles because what we ask them to do, normally they're on the clock and each side has 15 minutes only, and they have to state their major points in that brief period and answer questions from one or more of us who may ask questions. Today, though, we're going to ask each of the lawyers for each side before the arguments get underway to give each of you a little preview of what the cases that they're arguing are about and what the principal issues are. They will then begin the formal oral argument such as they would present if they were in Carson City in a regular en banc oral argument by the Nevada Supreme Court. The first case on calendar today is In Re the Estate of Bethurum, and I'm not positive I'm pronouncing that correctly. It is case number 57749. We have Gordon Muir as counsel for the appellant and Tamara Reed as counsel for the respondent. I will call on Mr. Muir first to give you each a little preview of what it is his side of this case is about, and then I will call on Ms. Reed to do the same, and then we'll begin formal oral argument.
Thank you, esteemed justices. Good morning. Thank you for this opportunity to be here, and thank you, Mr. Clark, and students of Reno High School for the opportunity to be present and share this case with you. I think it's a great experience for the students and for us as well, obviously. This case is about somebody who died. I would refer to as a trust and estates attorney. And basically, I represent a sister-in-law of the individual who passed away. He left a will when he passed away that left a substantial part of his property to his sister-in-law and to his sister to the exclusion of his stepchildren. And so when this will was presented to the district court for probate to see if the will was valid, it was contested, and the probate court decided ultimately that my client had unduly influenced the decedent, Mr. Arlen Bethurum, to basically make this will in his favor. The conclusion effectively was that my client destroyed Mr. Bethurum's own will and desires to name herself as a beneficiary, substituting her own will for his, and overcame his own personal desires and therefore left out his stepchildren. So this contest has resulted in that we have appealed to the Supreme Court, basically arguing that there was not substantial evidence in the lower court to show that my client basically destroyed her brother-in-law's wishes to leave his estate to her, but that they were his own desires and wishes to do so.
Thank you very much. Ms. Reed?
Good morning, Thank you.
Please return to address the students.
I will. Thank you. Good morning. Good morning, everybody. I also appreciate the opportunity to conduct the oral arguments here at the high school. I think it is a great chance for the students to kind of see what lawyers do in real life as opposed to television, like Justice Pickering mentioned. Just going off of what Mr. Muir said, my law firm represented the stepchildren at the trial court before we came to this appeal. And our clients wanted the probate commissioner to set aside this will that Mr. Bethurum had in place when he died and put a prior will of his as the controlling will. This prior will was the one where he left all of his belongings and his estate to his stepchildren. So what we did at the trial court was to argue that improper relationship developed between Mr. Bethurum, the gentleman who died, and his sister-in-law over a period of about a year and a half, during which time she convinced him to change his will, disinherit his stepchildren, and leave everything to her. And at the trial court level, we prevailed. And therefore, Mr. Muir and his client appealed to the Supreme Court, and now we are the respondents on the appeal and urging the Supreme Court to affirm what the trial court decided. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You may begin. And before he gets underway, the appellant has the harder row to hoe because the appellant lost in the district court. So the appellant gets to both open and close the oral arguments if he chooses. He can reserve time for what we call rebuttal, or he can elect not to do so. He has only 15 minutes, so if he reserves time for rebuttal, that's taken out of his 15 minutes. So with that, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
I hope to. Yes, I do, Your Honor.
Okay. How much time would you like?
I'm hoping just a few minutes is all.
Okay. Please put the clock at 3 minutes. You'll get a warning when it
you're
on that time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Esteemed Justices, thank you again for the opportunity to be here. I neglected to introduce Luke Federici and Associate. We're both of the law firm of Hawkins, Folsom, and Muir, and it's our pleasure to be here to argue this case on behalf of our client, Ines Caraveo. I'd like to address specifically the issues that this court has mentioned in its advice to us as to what the court wanted to hear, specifically addressing the difference between establishing undue influence versus raising the presumption of undue influence. I'd like to first note that I believe really the end result ultimately has to be the same, and that's that I just, as I mentioned before, that the will of the testator has to be destroyed and substituted by the will of the accused. But for that similarity, the elements really are the difference between the two of raising the presumption or establishing undue influence. But in reality, I'm not so sure that the difference is much more, it's more, much more of a difference in theory than I think it really is in reality. And to explain that, I'd just like to compare some of the key elements, referring first of all to the elements that the district court referred to basically four elements. The first element that the district court referred to is the opportunity to control based upon the relationship between the perpetrator and the decedent. And basically, the first element of the raising the presumption of undue influence is a fiduciary relationship. And I think the corollary, obviously, is that somebody who's in a fiduciary relationship obviously has an opportunity to control the outcome of the testator's wishes. And so when I say that there's not a real difference in reality, it's simply that the presumption gives us a shortcut to establishing that opportunity to control by having a fiduciary relationship. The two elements that are involved in raising the presumption would be a fiduciary relationship, and at least in the case of the Giacomo case, the testator lacking sufficient mental capacity to protect themselves from another person, including a fiduciary. Although I would note that in the case of In re Tiffany, even capacity is not an issue there when you have a fiduciary relationship. Similarly, under Chapter 155, the new caregiver statute, it doesn't matter whether the person is incompetent or incapacitated even there. If they have that relationship, and the examples that are given in the statute are a person who drafted the transfer instrument, a caregiver, and the person who arranged for and paid for the transfer, or a person who's related to any of those.
Well, so what did your client actually do that caused the district court to say that there was undue influence? What did she do?
Well, according to the court's findings, specifically, Ines reminded the stepchildren that they were unworthy of a share of his estate. Ines, during the joint lifetimes of Alan and Bertha, reminded them that they were unwilling to help with Bertha's care while she was ill. And then afterwards, only by telephone calls, 1,200 miles away, did she continue to reinforce that his stepchildren basically let him down when their mother was ill. That's all she did.
So why isn't this undue influence?
I don't believe it is undue influence, Your Honor. That's why we've appealed this case. There's not a single finding in the district court or probate commissioner's orders finding that Mr. Bethurum's will was overcome or destroyed in any way. There was no finding that Ines Caraveo substituted her will for her brother-in-law's. It was only a finding that she reminded him of things that he already had in mind. I don't see how you can overcome somebody's will when that's already their will. The finding was simply reminding and reinforcing what was already in the testator's mind. So I don't believe this is an undue influence case, particularly when that reminding comes simply from telephone calls 1,200 miles away. And maybe Justice, have a question? Or
I did. It seemed like there was a little more to it than that. There were indications that his wife had also made comments to the children that he was concerned that your client was making was bad-mouthing the children to him and him against the children.
Well, I would comment first of all, Your Honor, in that request that those comments basically happened during the joint lifetime of the decedent and his wife. After his wife died, there were simply the telephone calls. The finding of the court was that my client never returned to Reno after the funeral of his wife. So the only contact they had was by telephone call, and there's no direct evidence that this campaign to remind and reinforce and badmouth the stepchildren took place. But honestly, even if it did, I mean, this is a sister-in-law who dearly loved her brother-in-law and talked to him almost daily on the phone, as she did prior when her sister was alive, and continued those conversations. And to the extent that she did badmouth them, it was simply something reminding him what they had done and reinforcing simply what was already in his mind. It wasn't changing his will in any way. He felt that way already.
So our standard in reviewing this is substantial evidence to support the determination, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And then the burden that the challenger has is what? I guess that's the question here, is whether it's preponderance of the evidence or clear and convincing.
Well, and Your Honor, when it comes to that, obviously there's a very significant conflict between in the states as to what the proper standard is. I think historically here in Nevada, if you look at the cases, they tend to lean more towards a preponderance of the evidence. The Close versus Flannery case, or also known as In re Peterson, refers to a jury instruction where preponderance of the evidence was recognized as rebutting the presumption of undue influence by a preponderance of the evidence. We have an intervivals transcript, this being a higher standard. I'm not sure I agree necessarily with the rationale that it should be higher with intervivals transfers. But that's been the standard, certainly in Nevada, in the Giacomo case, in the Tiffany case, that there be a higher standard. I don't think it's illogical or contrary necessarily to all the policy rationales that we have different standards for the two burdens of proof, as the state bar amicus brief suggests. I think very clearly there's just as much public policy rationale to protect somebody who's accused of fraud by requiring a higher, clear, and convincing standard. This is a clear case where we've got a sister-in-law who simply was exercising her loving, caring, familial relationship with her brother-in-law and now has been accused and actually found guilty of fraud. On what basis?
Was there anything unique about the 2007 will when Arlen executed that will, the 2007 will? Was there anything unique about it as to who was present that was presented at the evidentiary hearing at the trial?
In an Indian influence case, I think it's very unique because in almost any other Indian influence case you read about, And even in California, when the presumption of legal when the legal presumption of undue influence is raised, they actually require that the fiduciary be actively involved in procuring the will. And often that's the case. You have the person paying for the will. You have the person driving them to the attorney's office. Ines Caraballo was 1,200 miles away. There's evidence that she had, uncontradicted evidence, that she had no contact with the CPA who prepared the will. The CPA only met her, I think, once or twice prior to Bertha's death. It's just not, that influence just is not there. And so that's a very key difference in this case where you don't have that. She wasn't involved nowhere around when that will was executed. We have two disinterested witnesses who were there when that will was executed.
Just one question, and the students would be interested in this too. What's the net value of this estate? How much money are you basically arguing over in this case?
Well, this case is started as a set-aside proceeding, which I believe the inventory was about $28,000. Why are we here? Partly because my client doesn't like being accused of fraud. I think the other issue that is important, and also I think relevant to the findings of this court and the probate commissioner's findings, is that there was a house worth about $200,000 that my client was named just a few weeks after being named as beneficiary in the will. She was named as a joint tenant owner of the decedent's residence. Obviously more value there. My opinion has nothing to do with this case. If they want to pursue that, that's a separate case. But I think it's relevant in the fact that that joint tenancy will, undisputedly, was prepared by an attorney. You know, there wasn't an attorney involved in the will for the circumstances that are largely set forth, but just a few weeks later, he is basically presenting a desire to have his house owned in joint tenancy with his sister-in-law, took it to an attorney. The attorney did it for him. We can assume and infer that the attorney must have advised him of what was going on and the effect of the joint tenancy. And so, you know, he's doing this on his own. There's no evidence that my client was ever involved with that.
Well, Mr. Moore, there does seem to be some evidence that Arlen was despondent, suicidal, after his wife died, in a very difficult emotional state, which your client, it would seem, was very aware of. When he deeded the property to her, put her name on the deed, and after he reconciled with one of his daughters and wanted to sell the home and move to Oregon to be with his daughter, in his despondent state, your client refused to let him sell the house and take her name off. Are those facts which the district court or the probate commissioner can consider in determining undue influence?
I think they're certainly facts, Your Honor, but let me also explain and put what you just said in context. First of all, the house was put in joint tenancy in May of 2007, about a year after the decedent died. Again, my client's nowhere around. She seeks independent counsel. Nowhere in the district court or probate commissioner's finding order is there any finding that he was suicidal. Not a finding, certainly during the time that the will was prepared. And I would suggest that just as much as his sadness and despondency, which the district court did find, was a factor, and I can't dispute that, you know, somebody can be maybe more easily influenced when they're in that estate, grief-stricken. I can only imagine losing a beloved spouse as Arlen did. But his pattern was to take steps to plan his estate when that happened. In May, when there were allegations that he was suicidal, that Arlen denied and his doctor found to the contrary, just weeks before, he was planning his estate. He prepared his will. He put his house in joint tenancy. A year and a half later, when November, December, just before he committed suicide in December, on December 30th, he was planning his estate again. He was, and he took steps to put his one of his daughters as a joint tenant owner with my client, who was already a beneficiary on the account, to do that. So his pattern was not to be unduly influenced to do anything when he was in those apparent states, but the pattern was to take steps to plan his estate, to do what he wanted to have done.
But his death was by suicide, correct?
His death was by suicide, Your Honor, yes. And with that, I think I would like to reserve some rebuttal time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Tamara Reed on behalf of the respondents, Anita Herrera-Perez and Sandra Kurtz. The respondents in this case, met their burden of proof to establish undue influence by the appellant, Inez Caraveau, over the decedent, Arlen Bethurum.
Now, that's my first question for
yes.
you. You say you meet your burden of proof. What is it? That seems to be unclear. Does it make any difference if it's clear and convincing or preponderance?
Yes, Your Honor.
From your standpoint, and you both conceded, I believe, that no presumption operates in this case that would cause you to apply clear and convincing.
And let me clarify our position. The court asked us to address two issues, the burden of proof and the quantum of proof, and I think it is very important to correctly refer to the two categories here. With respect to the burden of proof, I believe it is undisputed that the contestants of a will, the respondents in this case, carry the initial burden. The question is then whether the burden shifts to the proponent of the will or remains with the contestants of the will throughout the proceeding. The burden will shift to the proponent of the will if a presumption arises due to the existence of a confidential relationship and where the fiduciary benefits from the transaction. If there is no burden shift, our position is then that there's no presumption arises, and then the contestant carries the burden of proof throughout the proceeding. With respect to the quantum of proof, our position is that the contestant has a preponderance of the evidence standard, whether it be to raise the presumption or throughout the case. If there is a presumption and the burden shifts, then the contestant has a higher quantum of proof to rebut that presumption. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
Yes.
And again, then there are certain public policy reasons.
Let's follow on to that
yes.
analysis, Ms. Reed. Well, why don't you identify the facts present in this case that you consider support your satisfaction of a preponderance burden of proof?
And let me just begin. We will concede that the probate commissioner's findings weren't extremely specific with respect to all of the elements of undue influence. She did not go through each of the elements, and that is clear. But she did make a couple of important conclusions in her findings, and I just want to quote them. She recognized that an undue influence case is a fact-specific inquiry, and it depends on the totality of the circumstances. In her findings, she said that this case was a culmination of a set of facts that, taken alone, would not amount to undue influence, each individual transaction or each individual fact. However, when occurring simultaneously, such facts rise to the level of undue influence. And she further stated, and she used strong language, she stated that undue influence is manifest in the course of conduct of Inez Caraveau in fostering the ill will between the decedent's stepdaughters and Arlen. So she used pretty strong language there in her ultimate finding that based on the totality of the circumstances, undue influence was manifest in this case. And she, of course, was in the best position to weigh the evidence and judge the credibility of the witnesses. Both parties had an opportunity to present their witnesses, present their arguments to the probate commissioner, and then she weighed all of that and made the ultimate decision. And I would urge this court not to revisit her findings, despite the fact that they weren't specific with respect to each of the elements of undue influence.
But don't we have to find that substantial evidence supports that determination? And as you conceded, there's very little for us to evaluate in this case. Can you address also the length of his wife's illness, and as was indicated, a very significant aspect of this case is that he was terribly upset that the children didn't step in to help him with the care of his wife as she was ailing. And he was it was very clear from the record that he was quite upset about that.
Yes.
And that was what prompted him to, in fact, change his will. And that the sister-in-law is the one who, in fact, stepped up to help him during this difficult time.
That's true, Your Honor. And the timeline of events is important in this case. His prior will was executed in 2004, and that was the will where he left his estate first to his wife and then to his stepchildren. His wife died in May of 2006. And then a full year later, there was evidence presented that Ms. Caraveo, even though this was not reflected in the commissioner's findings, that she accompanied him to a meeting with his Catholic priest, a very intimate meeting where you would think a parishioner would attend privately with their priest. But Ms. Caraveo was there, and this was important evidence presented at the hearing about how involved she was with his personal affairs. And even this priest testified that it was his understanding that Ms. Caraveo was the one assisting him with his personal affairs and helping him manage his life.
Didn't the priest also indicate that very clearly he was upset with the fact that his children didn't, or that stepchildren didn't help him with his wife's care when she was ill? And on two occasions, in fact, he visited the priest and expressed that.
That is true, Your Honor. Those were the facts. Those were some of the testimony presented. But of course, our clients were also present and testified how the relationship was repaired after a while. What the appellant in this case repeatedly refused to acknowledge was his suicide attempt a few weeks after he executed this 2007 will, and that was kind of a turning point for Arlen. He recognized that he needed help more so than just from his sister-in-law, and he did then reach out to his daughters, and the relationship started to repair. He spent some time with one of his daughters in Oregon, and then over the course of the next year, the relationship improved, and as a result of that, our clients testified that he wanted to undo some of what he had done. They testified that he stated he had done something wrong and he wanted to undo that shortly before his death. So again, that was some part of the evidence for the probate commissioner to weigh, again, the credibility of the witnesses and the totality of the circumstances and the timeline of events.
But undue influence would not necessarily be judged in a rearview mirror. I mean, it's focused on the time at which he executed the will, correct?
Again, I would defer to the probate commissioner's findings of and her judgment of the totality of the circumstances. Of course, the most important time is leading up to the execution of the will. And in this case, yes, the suicide attempt occurred a few weeks after he had already executed it. But given the proximity in time and the evidence presented of how depressed he was, long-term depression in this case, because his wife had died over a year beforehand, I think that was a critical element for the probate commissioner to consider. And that really colored and overshadowed his execution of that will a few weeks prior.
To what extent should we consider the fact that the testator, the person who wrote the will, wrote it in a particular way and disinherited or took the stepchildren out? Should we not try to honor the testator's wishes in that regard?
The entire point of an undue influence case is because there were suspicious transactions and suspicious events leading up to the execution of this instrument. And therefore, it's not as if this was an instrument he executed 10, 15, 20 years beforehand that has remained untouched and has remained consistent throughout that time.
But isn't it, as a matter of policy, given that the testator wrote his will, he said what he wanted, he expected it to be honored, if you want to overcome that by saying, well, that's not valid because he didn't know what he was doing, there was undue influence exerted on him, why would we not require something more than just preponderance of the evidence, which is, you know, more likely than not, but rather clear and convincing evidence as a matter of policy to overcome the expressed will of the testator, that you would bear that burden if you want to overthrow that will. Why shouldn't we hold that?
There are a couple of reasons, and again, this is the public policy that the court should be concerned about. How is this going to play out in other similar cases? First of all, a probate proceeding, a will contest, is unlike a fraud case. Despite what Mr. Muir said, that his client was found guilty of fraud, that is not the case. A will contest case does not intend to punish a defendant. She's not going to be exposed to punitive damages or something like that, like you would be in a typical civil fraud case.
But there's a whole host of jurisdictions that liken undue influence to fraud and require that standard of proof.
That is true. That is true. There is a split in authority, but our position is that, nevertheless, still a majority of the states still require a preponderance of the evidence standard. And again, a will contest only seeks to set aside an instrument. For example, setting aside a contract, which would again be a preponderance of the evidence standard, unless it's setting it aside because of fraud. And again, another public policy reason for this court to consider is we want to protect those who cannot protect themselves. This has been expressed in the case law. We want to
counsel that.
Yes.
Tends to be a problem because we have a situation. We have a will executed. Some time goes by. There's a bank account. The bank account gets changed to bring one of the daughters back in. During this period of time, the deceased could have easily gone back and changed the will. You talked about looking at a totality of facts. So why do these facts lead to the conclusion you're talking about? If we look at him in an isolated situation, at the time he made the will, was he under the influence? But if you're asking us to look at the whole totality, he had capacity or he changed his mind. He demonstrated by changing the bank account, he could have likely changed the will if he wanted to. Why isn't that something that should have been considered, which also concerns me because of the limited record that the probate commissioner made as of the findings, just stating the kind of the totality?
That, again, would be an evidentiary question for the probate commissioner. Was he in the right frame of mind to go back and do that? Did he have sufficient resources, et cetera? Did he bring up the will? I don't believe there was any evidence.
The bank account was about $84,000, if I remember right, so resources didn't seem to be a problem about changing.
Right. I would just say maybe resources with respect to time and an attorney contact. He didn't have an attorney do the 2007 will, whereas each prior occasion he did. And there was testimony about, like I just stated, he wanted to undo what he thought he had done something wrong. And so that maybe played into maybe he was ashamed of what had happened the year prior, and he didn't get around to changing the will. But that was a question that was left
open. Was there anything adduced that showed that someone interfered in him changing the will or interfered with his exercise of his will?
I'm sorry, could you repeat?
Was there any evidence produced that demonstrated that his will was affected by the other party, that they interfered with him exercising that will?
Yes, Your Honor, there was evidence. We believe that there was substantial evidence presented to the commissioner to establish each of the elements of undue influence, that a confidential relationship developed between the appellant and the decedent, the daily contact by telephone, that she did attend an intimate meeting between the decedent and his Catholic priest. Again, that was not reflected in the findings, but it is in the transcript. There was plenty evidence that he was in a vulnerable condition and susceptible to undue influence for an extended period of time. He was in a deep and continuing depression. At the time of his attempted suicide in May 2007, he only weighed 115 pounds, and this was a man who was 6 feet tall. And therefore his natural defenses were lowered. And even if Mr. Muir argues that this was already in his mind, he was already disappointed with his children, that might be true, but the balances tip here when Ms. Caraveo then takes advantage of his weakened state and keeps on poisoning his mind against his children. That's the critical difference. Go ahead. I believe I only have 5 seconds left. Thank you very much.
Mr. Mayor, I had a preliminary question, and that is whether or not the findings, perhaps could you explain to me the findings made wherein it is alleged that your client arranged or facilitated the 2007 will to be prepared by a non-lawyer. Can you explain that to me? The finding is very brief here.
I understand your question.
It appears from the findings that your client assisted Mr. Bethune with getting to a person or someone, it's a non-lawyer, it's non-identified in the record, to construct the 2000, to redraft the 2007 will, the one that disinherited the stepchildren. To what extent was she involved with that?
She was not involved at all, Your Honor. And I think what you're referring to is the finding of the probate commissioner that Ines solicited the CPA to prepare the will.
Correct.
The district court found that that was an erroneous finding. We appealed that finding to the district court. There's no evidence that that happened.
Okay, and that was my question. Yes. To what extent, if any, was there such, I mean, that's a divergent finding, and I'm sorry to be taking up your short time, but that's, why was one finding made that she was participating in that process? Because that's significant to me.
I think it's very significant, because if my client had participated in the procuring, paying, anyway, doing that will, but even the CPA testified that she had no contact whatsoever with Ines. She barely knew her.
So
she met her, I think the evidence is twice briefly, once before Bertha died and then once at the funeral.
So complete misunderstanding with respect to that finding made by the commissioner.
Complete substantial error in my opinion. The district court found that it was harmless error. I think it's a very significant error, particularly an undue influence case when you look at all the facts and circumstances. With just a couple of minutes left, I would just, I guess a minute and a half left, I would just say, I read this case over and over again. I hear the arguments. I just do not see the evidence of undue influence. I think of cases that I am familiar with undue influence. There's isolation involved. There's diminished mental capacity. Obviously, there's no isolation. He was visiting his children. He had plenty of opportunities for 2.5 years to do whatever he wanted with his estate plan. He did what he wanted. And he did it at times when he was perhaps thinking that it was going to be the end because of not wanting to live because his beloved wife had passed away. But he did what he wanted. And I think the law strongly favors the presumption of validity of wills because we need to support that. There's no evidence of any testamentary incapacity here. I mean, he was gainfully employed. He drove himself to get the will executed. I mean, he had lunch with the witnesses who talked to him and satisfied themselves that he was doing what he was wanting to. You typically just don't see these types of facts in undue influence cases where a decision is made that the person's will is completely destroyed. And I would submit that did not happen in this case. Getting back to the standards of proof that are involved, I honestly don't have a real problem with a preponderance of evidence standard in real cases, particularly if we're just talking testamentary capacity. But if there's any inkling by any of the justices that this case, that they've met a preponderance of proof, I think the standard has to be clear and convincing evidence because this case is not an undue influence case. And my client should not be branded as a fraud because of what happened in this case. Thank you very much.
Can I pose one question? Mr. Mayor, I do have one question. There was no question or contest in this case about testamentary capacity. Is that right?
All of the parties, even the stepdaughters, admitted that he had testamentary capacity.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. The next case is coming up close on the heels of this one. What we like to do, though, is give the audience a chance to ask questions. But before we do that, can you all hear the arguments adequately? And the questions of the judges, are you hearing them okay? Okay. I want to do is open the floor for 5 minutes of questioning by the students of the lawyers or of the court. I have to make a preface on that, though, because we, the court, cannot say how we're going to decide a case until we decide it. Ethically, we're not supposed to talk about a pending case. So your questions to us, we might not be able to answer, but you can certainly ask them of the lawyers, and the lawyers will try to give you their best answers. Is there anyone in the audience who has questions of the lawyers or of the court generally about what we're doing here? We have a brave soul up in the bleachers.
This question is for the lawyers. Does it make a difference that the man committed suicide with the will?
Could you repeat the question?
This question is for the lawyers. Does it make a difference that he committed suicide in the will at all compared to somebody who did not commit suicide by natural death?
If I understand the question, it is difficult to hear even the justices, I think, unless we all speak directly into the mic, but if I understand the question, did it make a difference that he committed suicide with the validity of the will? Is that the question? Well, I think the issue is, when it comes to undue influence, is the person more susceptible to undue influence than a person of full mental capacity? Usually in an undue influence case, you have a situation where particularly in our day and age, as people get older, we see a lot of cases where the elderly develop Alzheimer's, dementia, and are very, very easily manipulated to do, honestly, whatever you want them to do without any problem at all. That's one extreme. The other side of an undue influence case is some person who is just old age or some has mental deformity, weakness, and the argument of the other side is that a person who is sad, despondent, grief-stricken, and suicidal can also be easily manipulated. So that's the issue that's presented in this case with the suicide. I think, obviously, as I've explained, I think the timing of the suicide a year and a half later makes a difference. But, I think that's the question, is whether a person who is in a mind of committing suicide, are they easily manipulated so that their own free will and judgment can be substituted by another's?
Ms. Reed, are you satisfied with that response, or do you want to speak as well?
And I think just in this case, what was important for our clients was the timing of his attempted suicide. That was close to the time when he executed that 2007 will. The actual suicide happened a year and a half later, so that is not usually as strong. For example, if he'd actually committed suicide immediately after executing that the will, that would have been even a stronger argument for us, would have been our argument.
Thank you. We have time for at least one more question.
I was just wondering how, do most cases take this long? Because you said it in, 2007. No, I meant, years. This case has been ongoing, not time-wise.
Here's my pitch for the Court of Appeals. In 2014, there will be on the ballot an initiative to create in Nevada a Court of Appeals. That Court of Appeals would be between this court, the Supreme Court, and the district courts. That will speed things up because we get so many cases per year. We get 2,500 filings in fiscal year 2012. If you just do the math on that, if we were going to drop everything and do those 2,500 cases that we got in 2012 immediately, we have seven of us, and we often decide cases in panels of three, so let's be generous and say we're all only going to work in panels of three instead of seven. The math works out to each one of us to work up a case would have to do three cases per day, 365 days per year, to clear those 2,500 cases. And the Supreme Court gets everything from appeals involving driver's license revocations, which really matter to the person whose driver's license it is, to death penalty cases which may have taken a month or more to try with daily transcripts on everything. So there is some delay in our court, and we are working as hard as we possibly can to process our cases quickly and effectively. But the sheer press of business has contributed to delays in the appellate process. There are also delays in the multi-level of review with this went to the probate commissioner first, then to the district court, and then it was appealed to our court. And before we can get to the meat of the matter, the lawyers have a chance to brief their case. So you have an opening brief from the person who's appealing and an answering brief from the person who's responding, and then a right of reply from the appellant. We then read the briefs and schedule the matter for oral argument, and then we caucus among ourselves and decide the case. So there's a bit of delay in the process, and I don't know in this case where the delay occurred and whether or not it's particularly delayed. I don't have the grasp of each step of the docket sheet. Sometimes lawyers ask for extensions of time on their briefs. That adds to the delay. In this case, I'm not sure why, but that's a very good question. Justice Hardesty, I see, is reaching for his microphone.
That was a great question, and I think one of the concerns that you as citizens in our state should be concerned about is how quickly it takes or how long it takes to have a case go through the judicial system. The core point is that some of you will be able to vote on this initiative in 2014. And I hope you'll take the time to take a look at this, because you can make a difference in the improvement of justice in Nevada. And I certainly know that the students of Reno High School are smart enough to figure this out.
Thank you. I think we have time for one more question.
I think I heard the question, and it was, is there any evidence that the stepchildren were estranged from the deceased? Great question.
Yes, so the deceased wasn't present to testify about the nature of his relationship with his stepchildren, because he was obviously passed away. So it came down to his sister-in-law and her witnesses and the stepchildren themselves testifying about the nature of the relationship that existed between the children and their father. And there was arguments by one side that yes, they were estranged, that he and some of the justices had questions about this, that he was angry at them because his wife was ill for a while and then passed away, and he wanted the children to kind of step up and assist with their mother's illness, and for various reasons they couldn't, so his sister-in-law was the one to help. But then as I argued later on, that relationship got reconciled because he reached out to his daughters and repaired that relationship. So there was evidence of both.
Do you want a brief response?
The facts aren't right there where I'd like them to be, but my recollection is that one of the stepdaughters did not have any contact with him whatsoever for a year and a half after her mother had died. The other daughter, if I think about the first 6 months, I think she did reach out to him a couple of times. He did not return her phone calls, but there was very little contact even by her during the first period of time. After about 6-7 months after she died, there was some communications with one of the stepdaughters and discussions of going to her house. And it's that stepdaughter who ultimately in November, December, was placed on one of the joint tenancy accounts.
Justice Seda?
It's something that you should understand. If you've noticed, even on what appear to be simple questions, our lawyers both want an opportunity to state their side of the case. The beauty of an appellate court, as we said, is that we have an entire record. Well, not a big record in this case, but in most cases, we not only have the lawyers who tell us what they believe to have been the facts or the evidence, but we are obligated to review the underlying evidence and record and transcript of any proceedings so that we understand, without bias to one side or prejudice to one side or the other, what actually happened. We too can review the facts as presented by our lawyers.
Okay, with that, this case will stand submitted. I want to thank both lawyers for excellent presentations, briefing, and argument. I would also thank the State Bar of Nevada for filing an amicus brief in this case. Amicus briefs are very helpful. What they are friend of the court briefs, and in them, interested groups can weigh in on what they think the law ought to be, and that's helpful to us. So thank you, everyone who participated in this. And the standard is, while we get the other lawyers up to argue the next case on calendar.